Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. I'm going to start with an article from AARP, the Bulletin, actually a bunch of short little articles. String over string. This is from the Bulletin. Flossing might replace the dreaded vaccination needle someday. Scientists gave flu and mRNA vaccines to mice using dental floss, triggering a robust immune response, says an article in Science Daily. Whether the mice had fewer cavities is not known. Next, Senate panel probes bias. Age discrimination is becoming subtler than ever and costing America some of its best workers, a Senate committee heard in September. One concern, artificial intelligence may be screening out candidates who appear to be older, AARP Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer Nancy LeMond told members of the Senate Special Committee on Aging. Algorithms that are used to scan resumes and applications can accelerate bias using graduation dates or years of experience as proxies for age, LeMond said. She cited other forms of age bias, from interviewers blatantly asking a person's age to using terms like digital native in ads to signal a desire for younger people. The hearing was organized by ranking member Kirsten Gillibrand, Democrat from New York, to focus on age discrimination in the workplace with the support of Rick Scott, a Republican from Florida. The Senate committee's chairman, AARP is supporting the bipartisan Protecting Older Americans Act of 2025, which would allow older workers who feel they have been discriminated against to sue employers rather than go through an arbitration process. And the last of these little articles, COVID vaccine guidelines change for older Americans. New guidelines mean getting a COVID-19 vaccine this fall may be more challenging than in previous years. Health officials are recommending that adults age 65 plus use shared clinical decision making by talking to a healthcare provider such as a doctor, pharmacist, or nurse before deciding whether to take the vaccine. People under 65 can also receive the vaccine using shared clinical decision-making and taking into consideration health conditions that increase a person's risk of severe illness from COVID-19. This year's guidelines are a departure from past years when the vaccines were more broadly recommended for anyone 6 months and older. The change is drawing criticism from some public health experts. Dr. Helen Chu, a professor in the Division of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the University of Washington School of Medicine, says the change introduces confusion to the patient about whether or not they're able to get their vaccine. Many other experts agree. Still, if a patient requests the vaccine, they will be administered it, a CVS health spokesperson tells AARP. As in the past, COVID shots will be covered by most insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, with no out-of-pocket costs. Those who haven't already received a flu shot can get it at the same time. The RSV vaccine is also recommended for adults 75 and older and people 50 to 74 with certain health conditions. Next, I'm going to start on an article from AARP, the Bulletin. And this is very long. It was their cover story, but it's of interest. So I'm going to read it, but I will read it in segments. We won't be able to finish it today. Living Solo: How Older Americans Are Embracing Independence and Redefining What It Means to Age Alone. This is by Sherry Horar. At 102, Mildred Kirschenbaum plays canasta and mahjong weekly with friends, sips her favorite vodka and tonic cocktail, it's medicinal, she quips, and trades stocks online. Living alone in Boca Raton, Florida, Kirschenbaum became a social media sensation at age 99, dispensing tart advice about aging via TikTok and Instagram. "I want to be alone," says the retired travel agent, a widow for 19 years. "I like my own company." Recent health issues have challenged her independence, but not completely. She stopped driving this year, but she did renew her driver's license. Kirschenbaum's story is unique, and yet she represents a growing trend in America of people from different backgrounds and circumstances who are aging solo. 21% of U.S. adults age 50 and older, that's 24 million people, now live alone, without a spouse or partner or anyone else under the same roof, and their numbers are growing fast. "The extraordinary upswing in aging alone is unprecedented," says Elena Portacolon, a professor of sociology at the Institute for Health and Aging at the University of California, San Francisco. "It's a reality check that times have changed. For many, it's about living your own life, following what is important to you. But our social supports have not kept up with the needs of those aging alone. In 1950, just 9% of all U.S. adults lived by themselves. Now, 1 in 5 Americans ages 50 to 54, about 1 in 3 ages 55 to 74, and half of those aged 75 plus are aging on their own, according to U.S. Census data. By 2038, the majority of people age 80 and older, about 10 million, will be solo agers, Harvard University experts estimate. Fueling this phenomenon are big changes in how Americans live, love, and age, says Portacolon. These include lower marriage rates, more gray divorces and marital separations, greater longevity and less poverty, along with older adults' desire to age in place, an increase in childlessness, and smaller, more far-flung families. There's a gender gap among solar agers, too. In 2023, 1 in 3 older women and about 1 in 5 older men lived alone, according to federal government statistics. Women live longer, but are more likely to stay single after being divorced or widowed. A 2022 study from Bowling Green State University found that men 55 and older are more than twice as likely as women to remarry, and other research suggests they're choosing younger spouses. Despite their numbers, solo agers are often misunderstood and even invisible. Older adults who live alone are generally healthier, more cognitively capable, and more socially connected than the broad group of older people living with their spouse or adult children, because they have to be, says Dr. Seishin Shaw, an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. The other side of the coin is they're more vulnerable when anything happens because they don't always have the support of others. What solo agers say. Until recently, our knowledge of the experience of older adults living alone has been limited, says Portacolon, the author of groundbreaking research about solo agers with cognitive decline and dementia. And while some receive support from relatives, friends, and neighbors, she says that many solo agers with thinking and memory problems are virtually invisible. Few people even know they exist, she says. So who are today's solo agers? To find out, AARP interviewed dozens of solo agers and the experts now studying and assisting them. AARP also surveyed 503 solo agers from across the U.S. about their feelings and experiences. What we found defies stereotypes, reveals surprising strengths, and uncovers some can't-be-ignored challenges. What follows are 5 insights into the lives of this growing age group. 1. Freedom and autonomy are tops. AARP's survey tapped into the full diversity of America's solo agers. Participants were never married, divorced, separated, or widowed, ages 50 to 95, lived in cities, suburbs, and rural areas, were racially and ethnically diverse, and had annual incomes ranging from less than $30,000 to more than $100,000. 40% had lived alone for 20 years or longer. One thing most agreed on, living on your own can be exhilarating and deeply satisfying. Oh, the freedom, says Gail Kirshenbaum, 70, a never married Emmy Award-winning filmmaker and daughter of Mildred Kirshenbaum from New York City. I have flying dreams. They're a metaphor for life. I don't want anyone to hold me down. Heather Nahrocki, Vice President of Experiences and Connections at our AARP, says there can be a lot of joy in aging solo. Feeling the freedom to choose their own path, solo agers are the captains of their own ship. They can pursue their own interests. There's a lot of positivity. The best parts of solo aging? For 1 in 3 survey respondents, it's freedom and autonomy. 16% said the best part is independence. Solitude is blissful, wrote one participant. I can do what I want when I want, noted another. I can put my own needs first, said yet another. They enjoyed small acts of independence, such as, I don't have to share the TV remote, drinking out of the orange juice container, and no one to clean up after. And they're savoring their accomplishments. This spring, Lester Shane, 73, directed the classic American play Picnic at the Sands College of Performing Arts at Pace University in New York City, where he's a voice, speech, and dialect coach. I think the great advantage of solo aging is you answer to no one, said Shane, who lived in an apartment at one time and has dated on and off since then. There's great freedom in that. Now, as we go through this article, there are spotlights, so let's look at the first solo ager spotlight. I did not think I would be alone at this age. This is Ruben Lopez Jr., 70, of Meridian, Idaho. Ruben Lopez Jr. was stunned when his wife told him she wanted a divorce 3 years ago. One of my first thoughts was, wait a minute, it wasn't supposed to happen this way, says the retired U.S. Postal Service mail carrier. I did not think I would be alone at this age. Like many older Americans who get divorced, Lopez adjusted his plans for retirement, finances, and social life. We were going to travel, he says. I was hoping to do that with a partner. I had to reset my life to decide how I wanted to live and what I wanted to do. In 2023, he moved from Southern California to Idaho, a place he had visited often and loved for its scenery and skiing. He overhauled his diet, started walking several miles a day, lost 30 pounds, and got off 2 blood pressure medications. Lopez's healthy lifestyle makes backcountry exploring easier. I fixed up the back of my SUV so I can put my sleeping bag, mattress, and coolers in there, Lopez says. I like traveling up into the mountains and camping overnight. It's a new life on a new budget. I can't do extravagant things, he says. The plan was we would be married, we'd have our Social Security and pensions, and we also save for retirement. We split that, but I had to settle some debt. I'm primarily living on a pension and Social Security. Last summer and fall, Lopez scoured garage sales, thrift shops, and ski shop sales for deals on skis, poles, and boots so he can hit the slopes this winter. I skied when I was younger, and I'm excited about getting back to it, he says. But at $100 for a lift ticket for a day, I won't go that often. Dating? Maybe in the future, he says. An early dating experience ended abruptly, and distinguishing real women from scammers on dating apps is difficult, he says. He's building a social life by playing his bass guitar in the worship band at a local church. Most of my life I've played for worship at church, he says. You can meet people and develop friendships because the music comes first. Now I'm going to move over to AARP the magazine and an article entitled Cook Your Way Out of Pre-Diabetes. This is by Rob Bloomer. Faced with high blood sugar, a professional chef found the remedy in his own kitchen. Here's how you can do that too. You are pre-diabetic. Those three words I never expected to read. After all, I've always kept myself relatively trim. At the time of my diagnosis, I was carrying 186 pounds on a 5'11" body. At 67, I had exercised like a fiend my whole life, and as a chef and former Food Network host, I ate really well, or so I thought. But there they were, three words scrawled by my doctor next to a slowly ascending line on my hemoglobin A1C chart, breaking through the pre-diabetes threshold, an average blood sugar level of 5.7%. I had never given the moment of thought to pre-diabetes. Chances are, neither have you. More than one in three American adults, approximately 98 million people, have pre-diabetes, and 80% of them don't know it. Pre-diabetes sounds relatively innocent. It's just a warning sign, right? But the reality is a bit darker. Up to 70% of people diagnosed with pre-diabetes will go on to develop the full-blown disease. And pre-diabetes is an expression elevator to heart disease, or an express elevator. Half of all people with pre-diabetes who don't take steps to address their condition will go on to develop cardiovascular disease within the next 5 years. Serious stuff. But my doctor's advice was vague. Watch your sugar and white carb intake was about all he had to offer. I decided to fully educate myself on pre-diabetes and use my skills as a chef to cook my way free of it. What the heck is pre-diabetes? It helps to think of it as a long smoldering ember that may or may not turn into a full-blown fire. When we eat carbohydrates, macronutrients found in everything from apples to chocolate cake, our digestive system breaks them down into simple forms of sugar, primarily glucose, which is then absorbed through the small intestine and into the bloodstream. As the level of sugar in our blood increases, the pancreas releases insulin, a hormone that helps cells absorb the glucose and either burn it off as energy or store it in our muscles and liver for later use. Carbs are digested quickly, while fat, protein, and fiber move through us more slowly. So, the higher the carb content of a meal and the lower the fat, protein, and fiber content, the faster those carbs are absorbed and the faster they cause our blood sugar to spike. As we age, and when we eat lots and lots of carbohydrates, the pancreas grows a little tired and lazy. It's no longer as effective at picking up on blood sugar rushes and releasing insulin to manage them. In addition, our cells can develop insulin resistance, which means they become less effective at reacting to insulin's orders. A less active pancreas, less sensitive insulin receptors, and a continued onslaught of carbs lead to elevated levels of blood sugar, which can lead to pre-diabetes and eventually type 2 diabetes. Being overweight has a similar effect. While the pudginess you see is likely to be around your midsection, weight gain happens throughout the body, especially in the liver and muscles, the very same storage facilities we're supposed to be using for excess sugar. The more fat we have in those locales, the less room there is to store blood sugar. The standard advice is pretty straightforward. Eat fewer carbs so you have less blood sugar to store, and exercise more to lose weight and build muscle, thereby creating storage space for your blood sugar. Your doctor might also want to prescribe metformin, which helps the body's insulin receptors regain their sensitivity, or a GLP-1 inhibitor like Ozempic or Wegovy, which helps boost insulin levels and reduce appetite, although neither has been approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to fight diabetes, and I would likely and would likely not be covered by insurance. They say that to a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Well, to a man with a spatula, everything looks like his next meal. I already exercised daily, and I wanted to do everything within my power to avoid taking medication. So I decided to lean on my chef's toolbox and knowledge to remake my diet. With pig-headed determination, I set out to minimize the unnecessary carbs I was eating. Instead of taking medication, I was going to cook my way out of pre-diabetes. For as far back as I can remember, my go-tos have been fresh-pressed fruit juices, homemade granola, sandwiches with lean protein and avocado, pan-seared fish with roasted potatoes, homemade pasta sauces, and stir-fries with rice. Of course, I've always had a mid-morning snack and a mid-afternoon pick-me-up cookie, or the like, with my coffee, and I would be remiss if I didn't admit to occasional dalliances with sweets, a weakness for French fries, and a love affair with wine. The common denominator in my healthy diet? Carbs, carbs, carbs. When I penciled out the carbs in my diet by reading the labels on the packaged foods I was eating and Googling foods like potatoes, rice, and pasta, I realized my average daily count was close to double the FDA's guidelines of 275 grams. No wonder I was pre-diabetic. Eliminating the sweets, reducing empty carbs like fries, and cutting back some on the wine would help, but most of the carbohydrates I was eating came from healthy foods, fruit juices, vegetable-laden pasta and rice dishes, and my crusty home-baked bread. And here's the thing. I liked the way I ate. I wasn't about to go on some fat-based keto program or a paleo diet that had me foraging around the freezer for elk loin. Instead, I established a few simple guidelines. No more than 100 grams of carbs per day. No weird diets or depressing stretches of hunger. No ultra-processed or pre-packaged food, even if they were labeled keto-friendly. Many still contain hidden carbs. Indeed, I would change how I ate, but not how well I ate. 3 months later, after equal measures of altered eating habits, creative cooking, and self-discipline, I had turned the trajectory of my A1C graph upside down, and in the process effortlessly dropped 15 pounds, returning to the weight I was in my 40s. 3 months after that, my A1C level dropped further to well within the comfort zone, and my new weight held steady, due solely to a radical reset of what I ate. I'm here to tell you, you can do this. Here's the way to get started. How to cook away your pre-diabetes. Get tested. Ask your doctor for an A1C test so you have a benchmark. Since it takes 3 months to move the needle, book yourself a follow-up blood test in 3 months and dig in for the short haul. Know your carbs. Get familiar with which foods and drinks are naturally high in carbs and the difference between good, complex carbs and bad, simple carbs. In a nutshell, the good ones are whole foods that contain lots of fiber, which slows the speed at which the body breaks down carbs and turns them into sugar. The bad ones are refined carbs like flour, white rice, and sugar, and everything made with them. And then keep count. Manage a rough running tally of the carbs you consume daily. Aim for a maximum of 100 grams per day. That's equivalent to about 2 slices of whole wheat bread, 2 medium-sized bananas, or 1 large potato. At the same time, don't lose sight of the FDA's guidelines of 2,000 to 2,500 calories per day. Avoid the carbohydrate bombs. Stay away from potatoes, rice, even brown rice. Anything made with refined white flour, pasta, bread, donuts, muffins, and all processed foods, cereals, granola bars, snack foods. Also, beware of anything containing sugar or high fructose corn syrup. Segue from carb-heavy to protein-rich foods. Lean on lean proteins, fish, chicken, lean red meat, tofu, dairy, unsweetened yogurt, and kefir, hard cheeses, and eggs. Studies have determined that transitioning to a low-carb, high-protein diet can have additional benefits as we age. Then be generous with healthy fats. Fats give us a sensation of being satiated, which helps make a low-carb diet achievable, even for a carboholic. Eat your veggies. Fill up on anything green and enjoy reasonable amounts of cauliflower, tomatoes, eggplants, mushrooms, bell peppers, garlic, and onions. Avoid starchy, high-carb culprits like corn and potatoes. Don't drink your fruits. Fruit juices can be high in carbs, but judicious amount of fruit in their whole form can fit into a low-carb diet. Make your own trade-offs. You are the boss of how you want to spend your daily 100 grams of carbs budget. While a single glazed cinnamon roll, 120 grams of carbs, will bankrupt you, an occasional appetizer-sized serving of pasta will not. Eat at home. Cooking for yourself gives you control over your carb intake and portion size. And unleash the flavors. Make every bite life-affirming by incorporating fresh herbs, spices, garlic, ginger, shallots, chilies, citrus zest, and the like. They add brightness and are virtually carb and calorie-free. Ditto for fish sauce and anchovies, Dijon mustard, balsamic vinegar, miso paste, and Parmigiano Reggiano, which add a depth of flavor. Now, I think we just have time for 8 top carb-cutting swaps. Pasta substitutes spaghetti squash spiralized zucchini. Instead of rice, eat rice cauliflower, steamed. Instead of bread, crackers, and buns, eat low-carb, high-fiber crisp breads. Instead of potatoes, eat oven-roasted celery root. Instead of beer and wine, drink pure distilled spirits like vodka. Instead of cakes, candy, all forms of sugar, eat 70% or more cacao dark chocolate. Instead of potato chips, corn chips, popcorn, eat nuts, pork rinds, carb-free jerky. And instead of dried fruit, fruit juices, fruits, and syrup, have judicious amounts of fresh fruit. Now, the other sidebar articles in this article contain recipes, which I don't have time to get into, but they are seed crackers and the ultimate low-carb Caesar salad. So both of those sound very yummy and good for you. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. I do hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join me next time. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.